Chapter 19. Exile Over. Now we return for a second look at Exile and Return, signpost 10. The exile to Babylon in 586 BC was the all-time low in Jewish history. It happened, you'll recall, after the reigns of kings Saul, David, and Solomon, when the nation split into two. The larger 10-tribe nation of Israel had already been taken off to Assyria and absorbed there over a century earlier. Then the new superpower, the Babylonians, attacked the remaining 2-tribe nation of Judah and dragged them too into exile. We noted earlier how this knocked the bottom out of people's lives. With the temple in ruins, Jerusalem sacked, and the people themselves dragged off to distant Babylon, they felt totally disorientated. Everything that had given their lives structure, meaning, and purpose had vanished. Only one speck of hope remained: the word of the prophet Jeremiah that the exile would not be forever. This became a major theme of Jewish expectation. Return from exile became the great national hope. The people talked about it all the time. It's what kept them going. Jeremiah had declared that the exile would last, in fact, for 70 years. For many of the older folk, that meant never seeing home again. But at least the younger ones could perhaps look forward to better things, and the nation as a whole could get back to something like normality. So they lived in hope, and with the 70 years up, sure enough, they got the all clear from King Cyrus of Persia to go back home. Even though, on the face of it, the return from exile was a big deal, we noted that it proved a bit of a damp squib when it came. For a start, only a small proportion of the exiled Jews took advantage of the chance to go home. The rest opted to stay put, having adapted to Babylonian life and ways. Then, when the returnees got back and gave priority to rebuilding the temple and getting the worship system up and running again, the end result was a bit disappointing. The new temple was a mere shadow of the splendid Temple of Solomon that it replaced, and God didn't show up in visible splendour at its consecration this time. But the biggest negative was the fact that, even though now back home, the nation was still not free and independent. It remained part of the great Persian Empire. They were still ruled by Gentiles. But, they hoped, things could change and maybe their independence lay not far ahead. They were disappointed. Despite their best efforts, they remained the puppets of one superpower after another. After 500 years, when Jesus came on the scene, they were still under foreign domination, by this time the Romans. So, while the exile was technically long over, it didn't feel like it. Being in your own land isn't quite the same when foreigners run the show and squeeze you for taxes, and foreign soldiers patrol the streets to keep you from rebelling. The great return from exile vision of the prophets wasn't in practice everything it had been cracked up to be. In real terms, it hadn't happened at all. That got the people looking again at the prophetic messages, and there they discovered that the prophet Daniel had provided a helpful insight. God had revealed to him that, in one sense, the exile would last not 70 years, but 70 times 7 years. That's 490 years. That period, he said, would come to a close with the appearing of a ruler designated the Anointed One, that is, the Messiah. The Jews began doing their sums, and by the days of Jesus, they reckoned that the time was just about up. That's why the Romans, around that period, had to cope with a steady flow of self-styled messiahs who all tried to rally Jewish forces to fight off the Roman overlords. The Romans beat them all down with an iron fist. They crucified them. This heightened expectation explains why so many Jews latched onto Jesus. Maybe he was the real Messiah at last. He certainly was, of course. But they couldn't see beyond their vision of a political and military Messiah, which they projected onto Jesus. To them, military might was all that mattered in the end. The best armed and best organized fighting machine always came out on top, so that's what Messiah would need to put together. It was the same sad old scenario that had blighted the world from time immemorial. Brute force, killing, rape and pillage. That's how society worked, so that's how the Jews would finally escape their prolonged exile and become a powerful, independent nation once more. Jesus would have none of that. God is love, not war and killing. Paradoxically, Jesus would sort the issue in a whole new way, through succumbing to the killing machine, then triumphing through resurrection. He would love his enemies, not slaughter them. The end of exile would be in peace, not war. What's more, the scope of this end of exile would go far beyond the petty political and territorial ambitions of the downtrodden Jews in Palestine. It would highlight the fact that people everywhere, whether Jews or Gentiles, are all in exile, far away from their longed-for home of a peaceful, prosperous and purposeful existence, where they live in harmony with God and one another. The Old Testament shows the exile to be the consequence of Israel's sins, so return from exile is inextricably bound up with the forgiveness of sins. Sin, of course, is a universal problem, not just a Jewish one. Happily, the death of Jesus accomplished the forgiveness of sins for Jews and Gentiles alike, and thus the end of exile for all. Jesus, declares Paul, is the one in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Redemption, there's that word again. In this terminology, exile is a form of slavery from which Jesus has redeemed us. Our sins are forgiven, and all of us are free now to go home. But where is home? For us, certainly not Jerusalem. The scope of what Jesus achieved by his death goes far beyond people returning to a Middle Eastern city. The forgiveness of sins is way bigger than that. There is another Jerusalem. The New Testament calls it the New Jerusalem, as distinct from the old one. This is a metaphor for God's people at home. It's a way of saying the community of those who have heard and acted on the Cyrus-like voice that says, "You're free to return." It embraces all those who, realizing what Jesus has accomplished, have upped sticks and left Babylon, accepting the invitation to go home to where God lives among his people. I'm one of them. I can say that while, naturally speaking, I live in Cornwall, England, spiritually speaking, I live in the New Jerusalem. I'm part of the worldwide community of Jesus people, sometimes called the Universal Church. How about you? Cyrus is still saying you're free to go home. What's to stop you doing it? Unless you're too settled in Babylon. The New Jerusalem today, the church in the sense of Jesus people together, is an outpost of heaven on earth. True, much that currently goes under that name is pathetic and lifeless, but let's judge church by its best expression, not its worst. Church, as God intends it to be, is a colony of that better society marked by peace, joy, harmony, and shalom, which will one day be universal. The writer of the letter to the Hebrews addresses followers of Jesus this way: "You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem." We are there already, part of local churches that are, by definition, made up of people determined to trust and follow Jesus. But there's a day coming when the New Jerusalem will become the biggest thing, in fact the only thing. The last book in the Bible struggles to find words adequate to describe its wonders. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and will be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." That glorious state of affairs is still future. It awaits the age to come after Jesus returns. By comparison, what Christians enjoy in the present-day New Jerusalem is limited. In spite of the huge positives, we are still prone to sin and weakness. Some of our fellow citizens too easily rub us up the wrong way. But the prospect of the full deal keeps us going. Hope is a great encourager. Take note, then, of this important signpost, return from exile. It points your way to better things here and now, as well as brilliant prospects for the future.